To study the development of human government is to come eventually to the study of democracy. Students of Western civilization especially learn fairly early in their courses about the role of the Athenians in fashioning the rise of the rule by the people, democracy. As the Athenians practiced it, democracy assigned to every citizen equal authority to decide on matters of policy. And so, not even a declaration of war against enemies like Sparta, who took a much different view of policy, could come to pass without the votes of a majority of the citizens of Athens. You can just imagine the problems that arose with trying to assemble such a majority. The Athenians and those neighboring city-states that followed the Athenian model during the 5th and 4th centuries before Christ claimed a certain superiority for themselves, especially compared to Sparta, because the Athenians professed that they believed in self-determination. Now, of course, the rights of citizenship operated within certain limits. That usually meant that women had no voice, and that members of the laboring or servant classes had little ability to influence policy or events, even though those things affected them. The whole system proved to be unworkable because it was nearly impossible to administer. When crises erupted, as they tend to do at every point of history, the people found themselves either uncertain about how to respond or sharply divided. The Greek civilization could not survive very long in such circumstances, and it didn't. And eventually, the Romans refined the Greek ideas and instituted what they called a republic. The theory of a republic is that the people elect representatives who make decisions for them. But even in the case of the Roman Republic, certain situations appeared to be beyond the ability of the elected representatives to control. And eventually, the Republic transformed itself into an empire through the energy of Octavius, who became known as Caesar Augustus. The government of the children of Israel during their years in the wilderness was not according to either model. It was not a matter that was up to the whims of the people to decide. God placed the authority for the government of his people into the hands of Moses, who shared some of the responsibility with his brother Aaron and with Aaron's surviving sons, Eleazar and Ithamar, two other sons having been put to death by the Lord for their blasphemy at the tabernacle. Not long after the disastrous refusal of the people to enter the promised land at Kadesh Barnea and the Lord's condemnation of them to wander for 40 years in the wilderness, a notable rebellion arose in the camp of Israel. And we have read of that rebellion today. It came, first of all, from the tribe of Levi. represented by Korah, and it came also from some descendants of the tribe of Reuben. Now the rebellion of Korah came from his part of the tribe that the Lord did not choose for the priesthood. Beyond the envy over being excluded from the priesthood, the authors of the rebellion challenged the leadership of Moses. They made the argument that Moses and Aaron were guilty of pride and ambition in taking to themselves the leadership of the people. There was the indication that those who raised the challenge, however, were the ones themselves who were guilty of pride and ambition. And that comes through as we read in verse 3, they said to Moses and Aaron, "Ye take too much upon you." And if we go down to verse 7, we see the reply of Moses, "Ye take too much upon you, ye sons of Levi." Now the argument they made was striking in a world that knew nothing of the rule of the people at large. All of the people, they said, were equally capable of being in leadership. And so that Moses and Aaron were in that position was the sign of their desire to lord it over everyone else. Here was one of the moments of great crisis that marked the years in the wilderness. There would be others, but here was one of the first, and it culminated in a dramatic demonstration, as we read, of God's sovereign control of His creation and of His people. The incident of Korah and Dathan and Abiram that ended in such a shocking manner served as a reminder afterward that God is the one who sets His servants in places of leadership, and that discontent with those decisions amounts to discontent with God Himself. It was very striking, in fact, to read in verse 11, "For which cause both thou and all thy company are gathered together against the Lord." Moses was saying, "Your complaint is not with us, it is with the Lord." It must have seemed that the people would never reach the promised land if such critical developments continued to arise. They were barely started on their 40-year journey. How would they ever get to the end? So early in the time of wandering, the purpose of God for the people faced a stern test in democracy's rebellion. Democracy's rebellion. The government of the Church of Jesus Christ in the New Testament became a study in the blending of the people's voice with the purpose of God. The process by which God's purpose came to fruition through the voice of the people. Presbyterianism rests on the ability of the people to choose their leaders, while at the same time deferring to the purpose of God in the choice of such leaders. In Presbyterianism, the decision of a congregation is subject to the review of the presbytery. And the presbytery retains the ability to disallow the election on evidence of irregularities in the process, or on evidence that those whom the people have chosen will not commit to maintaining the truth of God in the church. In Old Testament times, however, there were no elections. Moses occupied the place of leadership, not because Moses sat down and said, you know, I'd like to be in charge of the whole people. I think I'll campaign to that end. He occupied the place because God called him to it, and because God equipped him for it. So for Korah and Dathan and Abiram to argue otherwise was to rebel against God himself. And the effects of that rebellion extended to their families and their possessions. God wiped them off from the face of the earth. Still, even in this incident of great devastation in the camp of Israel, there was also a powerful message of the gospel. For we read at the end that Aaron made an atonement for the people, and that he stood between the dead and the living. There were those who survived that judgment from God because of the blood of redemption. And their survival was evidence that God provides a way of salvation for those who lie under his just condemnation. Now, when we look at this chapter, we observe four steps that are evident in this rebellion. Step number one, defying God's authority. Defying God's authority. We find that in verses 1 through 3 and then verses 12 through 15. The language of the opening verses of the chapter is the language of revolt. And now let us remember the context here. It comes very soon after the refusal by the people to follow the counsel of Joshua and Caleb at Kadesh Barnea to enter the land of Canaan at that time. The people wouldn't do it. It was probably the case that the people who engaged in this revolt in Numbers 16 harbored lingering resentment for the way in which the 10 spies that brought the unfavorable report about the land suddenly died. God put them to death. And the revolt that we find in Numbers 16, I believe, was the product of simmering refusal to accept the judgment of God at Kadesh Barnea. So let us learn the lesson well. When you refuse to humble yourself under the mighty hand of God and to accept his judgments, you set yourself up for even more dire consequences. Now notice the language of these opening verses. In verse 2, they rose up. They rose up. The Holy Spirit chooses his words with care. They rose up. The idea is they were going to face down the leaders of the people. These three men, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and others who joined with them inspired 250 princes among the people, leaders from each tribe, to take their stand against Moses and Aaron. In verse 3, we read that they gathered themselves together against Moses and Aaron. And what did they do? They accused Moses and Aaron of exalting themselves over the people. You take too much upon you. Why are you exalting yourselves and lifting up yourselves above the congregation of the Lord? Why? It was a challenge to them. Why are you doing this? Why are you telling us what to do? Now, the spirit that animated this challenge appeared a little later when Moses called Dathan and Abiram to appear before him, and they refused to do so. You look at verse 12. Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. These were men from the tribe of Reuben. And they refused. Notice the words at the end of verse 12. They're words of defiance. We will not come up. So here the message came from Moses. Moses has summoned you to appear before him. You tell Moses we're not coming. That was the spirit of these men. Tell him we're not coming. And then at the end of verse 14, we hear it again. We will not come up. And what did they do instead? They charged Moses with being arrogant. They charged Moses with lying. They charged Moses with not carrying through on the promises he made. And notice that they even said that the land that they had left in Egypt was the land flowing with milk and honey. That was the land that God had promised them, a land flowing with milk and honey. Now they said, you took us from such a place to kill us here in the wilderness. And now you're making yourself a prince over us? Now you're taking authority over us? And then they said in verse 14, you haven't brought us into a land that floweth with milk and honey. You haven't given us inheritance. Here was the resentment still simmering from what happened at Kadesh Barnea. So they said, no, we're not coming. Now Moses, of course, was entirely blameless. Moses had done nothing but what God called him to do. But there's always this willingness, you see, on the part of wicked men to defy God's authority in setting up leadership. They were challenging God's actions. They were challenging God's purposes. We will not come up. Moses said to the Lord, I haven't profited from these people in any way. And notice what the genius of the argument was for this defiance. And we find that in verse 3. All the congregation are holy. You take too much upon you, Moses and Aaron. All the congregation are holy, every one of them. And the Lord is among them. In other words, they're saying, Moses and Aaron, there's nothing special about you. Everybody is on the same level. All of the people should have an equal voice in the decisions and an equal entitlement to the authority of leadership. And ultimately, this defiance was not toward Moses. Oh, they said it was. But the Holy Spirit has told us it was against God. It was against Jehovah. Moses was only the human representative for the Lord. And ultimately, the defiance was against God himself. What was to be the response to that defiance? Well, that brings us to the second step in considering this rebellion, declaring God's calling. Declaring God's calling. Verses 4 through 11 and 16 through 22. Moses knew that the revolt was against God. He understood that quite well. And he devised a test by which the Lord would demonstrate that reality. The emphasis of Moses in verse 5 was that God's sovereign prerogative was under attack. He spake unto Korah and to all his company, saying, even tomorrow the Lord will show who are his and who is holy. They had said, everybody is equally holy. And he said, tomorrow you're going to see whom the Lord has chosen. Even him whom he hath chosen will he cause to come near unto him. Here's the issue: God's sovereign prerogative and purpose. And there would be an object lesson. Every one of the rebels was to bring a censer, a container of incense, and was to lay it before the Lord at the tabernacle. And the Lord would indicate which censers he favored. Moses was making known again here that the gifts and callings of God are without repentance. So he argued, God chose the sons of Levi for holy uses. He said that to Korah. Is it nothing to you that God has already set you apart to be in the service of the tabernacle? To be engaged in that service? But you desire the priesthood too when God has not set you apart for that? They wanted access to the priesthood because there was power. There was authority. There was prestige. And we notice the extent of the rebellion in verse 19. Korah gathered all the congregation against them unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. Here were Moses and Aaron, and Aaron's sons. They were by themselves. Here, I say, is the rebellion of democracy. Oh, they were the vast majority. They were all against them. If you took a poll, Moses and Aaron would be swamped. They would be defeated. There was sympathy all through the congregation for this rebellion. They were all saying, yeah, what do Moses and Aaron have to do to exercise this authority over us? What was God's response to Moses and Aaron? You get away from these people. I'm going to wipe them out. I'm going to destroy them all. And it was only the intercession of Moses and Aaron. Here, the people who were under attack, they were the ones who interceded to turn aside that destruction. It was the means by which the calling of God appeared again. So the response of Moses to this defiance was to reassert God's calling. Moses did not give up any ground at all. Even though he was hopelessly outnumbered, he knew what God had said and what God had done. And the lesson for us to learn is for us to know in our hearts the calling of God. Because in difficult straits, in straits of crisis, you can rely on that calling of God. And I say that when I teach in the seminary to our students there for the ministry, you need to know the calling of God. And let us come to the third step in this rebellion, destroying sin's folly. Destroying sin's folly. Verse 23 through verse 35. Moses took his stand. Everybody was against him. But he took his stand. He knew what was right. And the determining factor in the situation would be the manner in which Korah and Dathan and Abiram would die. Verse 29. If these men die the common death of all men, or if they be visited after the visitation of all men, then the Lord hath not sent me. So he's saying to the people, here's how you're going to know. But if the Lord make a new thing, and the earth open her mouth, and swallow them up with all that appertain unto them, and they go down quick into the pit, then ye shall understand that these men have provoked the Lord. So here Moses was saying, here's how you're going to know. If the manner of their death is like that of everybody else, then you'll know the Lord has not sent me. But if the earth opens unto them, and swallows them up and everything they have, then you'll know that God has done it. And so it came to pass. Striking, isn't it? As soon as he got done speaking, the earth opened. Now, we're not told what the naturalistic explanation is, whether it was an earthquake or whatever, but we know that there have been earthquakes where big gaps open in the earth's crust and where things fall into them, and when the earth comes together again, they're not seen anymore. But in some way, the earth broke asunder right where they were, right where they were standing. And down into the pit they went. I think there is a double meaning there. They went down into the pit, in other words, the pit that the earth's opening fashioned, but they went down into the pit in that they went down into hell, never again to be freed. What of the 250 princes? What of them? They were not swallowed up as Korah and Dathan and Abiram and all their households and all their possessions were. But the Lord sent fire out from heaven and devoured those 250 men. So in every tribe there was the loss of leaders who had rebelled against God. And there was to be a memorial of this judgment. Moses directed that Aaron should retrieve these 250 censers and take the metal of them and fashion them into covering plates for the altar, that every generation can be reminded of the folly of rebelling against the calling of God. You take too much upon you, they said. And then they were gone. And that brings me to the fourth step. Delivering the Redeemer's people. Verses 36 to 50. Now you would think, would you not, after such a dramatic event, that the fear of God would have settled upon the rest of the people. But we find that there was persistent refusal and resistance against the judgment of God. Verse 41, on the morrow, all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, ye have killed the people of the Lord. Somehow or other, Moses and Aaron had figured out how to make the earth open, and all these people went down into it. You are the ones who killed the people of the Lord. Now, here is a picture of the extent of depravity in the heart. And God said, that's it. I'm going to wipe out the rest of them. And so we find in verse 44, the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, get you up from among this congregation, that I may consume them as in a moment. And they fell upon their faces. And Moses said unto Aaron, take a censer, and put fire therein from off the altar, and put on incense, and go quickly unto the congregation, and make an atonement for them, for there is wrath gone out from before the Lord, from the Lord. The plague is begun. Aaron had to make an atonement for the people. So we read that Aaron, the priest of God, stood between the dead and the living. The dead who had already succumbed to the plague of divine judgment, Aaron stood between the dead and the living. And the plague ceased. There was the message in this judgment of divine grace and mercy in the face of the judgment of God. The way of deliverance is the way of the blood. The way of deliverance from the wrath of God is the way of the sacrifice. So the way to stop the judgment of God is for that judgment to fall on the substitute, and for that substitute to shed his blood as an atonement for sin. Atonement by the blood. So here in the midst of this awful visitation of divine judgment, there was a message of the gospel. The only answer for the wrath of God is the blood of the atonement. So Aaron took the fire from the altar of sacrifice, put it into his censer, so that the incense arose before God, and that was that which satisfied God. He stood between the dead and the living. What a picture of mediation and intercession in the action of Aaron. And the message is today that the people of God do not rest upon anything to do with them. They don't rest upon their opinions. They don't rest upon their confidence in their own works. They rest in the blood of the atonement. And they put everything on the power of redemption. That is the way of deliverance. So in the face of democracy's rebellion, in the face of the proclamation that all of these people are against you, Moses and Aaron knew where real deliverance lay. And they claimed that power through the blood of the atonement. And they knew the reality that God intervenes to deliver his people from their sins. May God then give us grace today to keep looking unto the blood of the atonement as that which shelters us from the wrath of God.